once you start to get isolated from the pack, which is most men in modern culture, oftentimes they don't have community. Oftentimes that's when you start the shame spiral, and you start the shame spiral. That's where the death sentence comes in.
There is times to intentionally choose solitude. If you need to create something different, if you need to find some truth, it's important to make that distinction that sometimes men do have to leave a tribe that is not supporting them. And sometimes it is time to find a new tribe, but it can't be an identity. That's when men get stuck.
In this interview, I'm joined by Joshua Wenner and Philip Folsom. They're the founders of K4, a men's leadership community which equips men with psychological tools and resources to become their best selves and create a better life for their families and their communities. Their members include entrepreneurs, combat veterans, leading mental health professionals, first responders, doctors, lawyers, artists, and musicians, and everything in between. In this conversation, we explore some of the core ideas and philosophy that K4 is built upon, including the four masculine archetypes, including the king, the warrior, the magician, and the lover, and how to fully embody these to thrive in the modern world, why it's important for men to aim to be both good and powerful, and why it's important to realize that this isn't an either-or choice, shadow work and how to integrate the wounded parts from your past, and more. You can learn more about their work and community at k4men.com. Okay. I'm joined here by Philip Folsom and Joshua Wenner. We're going to be speaking about, I suppose, modern masculinity. They're the founders of K4. It's basically, I'll let these guys say more about it, but it's basically an online community and structure for men to really become the best version of themselves. I'm probably doing a bad job of describing that, but that's what it is. The first question I wanted to ask you guys was, so most men in our culture are faced with a choice between either being good or being powerful, right? So why is this a false dichotomy? Is it possible to be both? And is there any examples from culture that you think that you could point to say, that's an example of someone that is good and powerful? So we can start here with Philip, if you want to jump in.
Yeah, that's kind of my wheelhouse on that one. the combination of good or powerful is timeless, and it is a heroic ideal. And the heroic ideal has been part of every culture from every area and every era in humanity, is men that can be both good, respected, benevolent, altruistic, but also powerful. And our society has broke those two pieces apart and pushed it into the men who are sensitive and vulnerable and or powerful, right? Which is the savage man, who is the toxic masculine man. And so the fact that they have stolen that birthright of a heroic ideal for men is one of the core tragedies of our society. And so the reclamation of that heroic ethos is part of what K4 is about. It's that we actually, not only do we deserve and our people demand that heroic identity, but it's something that is a birthright of men, and it's something that is aspirational to achieve. And even if it is somewhat unrealistic to, you know, shoot for Achilles or any of these, you know, mythological heroes, they still provide that roadmap for men to navigate their life off of. That's the North Star of the heroic ideal. And so, you know, it only exists really mythologically in terms of the initiation stories that we have. But there are a lot of men throughout history who have embodied that ideal, all the way from, you look at Marcus Aurelius. You know, he was, you know, seen as being that philosopher king who held both of those poles incredibly well.
That's a great example. Any other examples come to mind? And for you, Joshua, apart from Marcus Aurelius?
Go ahead. Do you have some, Philip?
Well, I would just say there is a contemporary movement that we're seeing, you know, across the, you know, the communication platforms, that there are men who are rising above the fray and reclaiming that. And I think over here in the United States, you're looking at, you know, Joe Rogan, Jocko Willink, you know, there is a rise of what I refer to as great men that are appearing on the horizon now. And there has been certain moments in the timeline of human history where there has been pockets of great men that arose. And in Greece, you know, you have Aristotle, you know, Plato, Socrates, and what they generated with Alexander the Great and Ptolemy. That was a high point of human history where you had powerful, good men who were functioning in the world. The Enlightenment of Europe powered the American Revolution, where our founding fathers were these holistically based in the time that they were living. Those were holistically heroic men. They could design their own houses. They could duel. They could speak four languages, and they could start a country. And so there have been moments in history where we have generated a corona of great men who embodied that heroic ideal. And I see that happening now. I think that we're on the stage of generating some incredibly powerful, benevolent men.
For sure.
The only other pieces I would add is when Philip mentioned, like, there's been all these examples, where did it go? That's really Industrial Revolution from the lens I look through. Is Industrial Revolution, we wanted people to work. We wanted men to work. And so when you went to work, if you're also in your emotions, like, you're not going to be as productive. You're not going to be as efficient. So it was, my belief is that's where a lot of this languaging came in of what the man is, which was cutting him off and making him choose. Are you going to be this weak man who's connected to his emotions? Or are you going to be a strong man and get more production done, like from a high level? Because that's where the rite of passage we're taking from. It's also from my lens of studying emotion. That's also where we cut off from the emotional pieces, that it wasn't, we weren't a man if we had access to our emotions, right? So they were both conditioned to actually be more productive and more efficient. And the only other example that I would give is The Rock, because we asked that in a lot of our guys, is like, well, who are examples? And The Rock tends to come up quite a bit with men of like, oh, here's a guy in his heart that also has power. Or Jason Momoa is another guy that I hear quite a bit of, a guy that's playful and fun and gregarious, but also can stand in his power. So just a couple other examples.
Very cool. I want to go back to something Joshua said there about Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. Like, that's incredible that pocket of men had that kind of influence in the world. And then obviously, so Socrates taught Plato, Plato taught Aristotle, and then Aristotle taught Alexander the Great. And like, their influence still lives with us today in modern culture. And then you guys have this, you know, you run K4, and one of the things you help people do is essentially build a tribe and provide that tribe for people. Can you tell me, you have a really good podcast in this, but why does the lone wolf always die? And Josh, we can start with you this time and then jump to Philip.
Yeah, well, I got this from Philip. So Philip's really got the wolf wisdom around this, but I've been around it enough to learn it and to embody it as well. And really, the lone wolf dies because he needs a pack. You know, those are, without the pack, the wolf dies. And so our culture's been almost as a pride of honor if you're a lone wolf, where in actuality, when you hear that wolf howling, he's howling because if he doesn't find a pack, he's dead soon. So it's another frame that we teach, when we teach, like, even in our Valor, which is teaching fire, police, military, is once you start to get isolated from the pack, which is most men in modern culture, oftentimes they don't have community. Oftentimes that's when you start the shame spiral, and you start the shame spiral. That's where the death sentence comes in. And if you look at current suicide rates, just not with fire, police, military, but even with men, I think it's the second leading cause of men under 44 suicide, right? So that's where, from our perspective, not having tribe, not having practices in tribe to reclaim healthy masculinity, you end up isolating and you start that death spiral towards death.
Yeah, sure. Anything to add to that?
And, you know, my exploration and kind of discovery of that axiom came from my struggles of you know, reintegrating from the military, which I had tribe, I had affiliation, I had a sense of belonging. And we don't have suicide when men are deployed and embedded in that kinship system, whether that be sports, a fraternity, a men's group, the military, whatever the tribe is. You're not seeing a whole lot of clinical anxiety, depression, addiction, suicide. It's like Josh said, when they're, you know, struggling with the reintegration back into the civilian world, which consists of a gigantic pack of lone wolves who do not have that sense of kinship with each other. And one of the stats on that is in America, we've lost just under 8,000 soldiers to action in our wars over the last, you know, 20 years. Same time period, we've lost over 150,000 to suicide. And they all happened back in the civilian world. So the lone wolf literally dies. And then kind of an interesting parallel story to that as well, in that there are times to be a lone wolf. And in the wolf pack, there are, when a pack gets to a certain size and there is not a role for a member who has, call it a destiny or a nature to fulfill, they do have to choose to leave a pack where they're not able to achieve or embody their, you know, their destiny. So they do go off on their solo journey to find another pack which does have a place for them, or to create a new pack. And that phase is called the interloper in wolf biology. But it's two things. Number one, it's short term, and number two, it's intentional. And that would be the difference between isolation and solitude. There is times to intentionally choose solitude if you need to create something different, if you need to find some truth. And that's really what the vision quest in the human expression is there is times to, you know, disengage from the world, to do your own work, to create your own journey, or to transition to another tribe. And so it's important to make that distinction, that sometimes men do have to leave a tribe that is not supporting them, that is not celebrating their journey. They're threatened by their success. And sometimes it is time to find a new tribe, but it can't be an identity. That's when men get stuck.
Yeah. And I'll just add one more piece. At least what I've observed, part of the reason that happens is when we're alone, we don't have any reflections of who we are, how we're navigating through the world. And oftentimes, if you don't have maps and tools, which is a lot of what we teach in K4, you're kind of just floundering around with no good examples of healthy masculinity. And then you're bumping up against, you know, really deeply wanting, let's call it, stepping into your purpose. You're wanting to take care of your body. You're wanting to, you know, create a family unit, create a legacy. And when you can't do that, or you destroy it, or you start to have these, what we call adolescent behaviors that you're not aware of, but you've learned. So you're just doing what you've learned. You're becoming what you've learned from what you observed. And you can't figure it out. That's what typically feels like, oh man, it'll lead to the shame spiral. And that's what starts to pivot out when you're around a group of men and you start to realize your story is universal, maybe a slightly different story, but men are all struggling with very similar challenges. It normalizes what you're going through, and it tends to absolve that shame and realize that there are paths. And that's a lot of what we've even created, like, hey, how do we use stories to bring back relevant ways of being a healthy man? And then once you learn the maps and tools, you now know how to navigate that, and you see other men getting results. So there's something really powerful about the tribe of, one, absolving your shame so you don't go deeper down the shame spiral, and two, getting a pathway, like, who is winning? And let me observe, what are you doing to win? And can we start to father each other, father ourselves, and then father each other?
And really, shame and accountability are the same thing, except when we're a lone wolf and we receive any critical feedback, we interpret it as shame, and which is very destructive. But if we're embedded in a pack and we receive some critical feedback, it's viewed as being held accountable. And so we need engagement and support and accountability from our tribe. we will always do more out of a sense of honor, which is the service to something larger than ourselves, than we will do for ourselves, which is pride, one of the seven deadly sins. So shame and accountability is very similar to pride versus honor.
Got you. I want to go back to what you said about the veterans. So both of you guys are veterans. You're saying there's something, was it 4,000 or 5,000 have died in combat? And how many thousand have committed suicide roughly?
Over 150,000. And which does not, it's actually, that's a low ball number because it does not include suicide by cop, intentional vehicular accidents, a lot of the overdoses. So it's, the number is actually a lot higher, and it is an epidemic. And Josh, share the suicide stat with police and fire.
Yeah, it's you're actually more likely to die from suicide than you are a line of duty death. So from running into a fire, you know, some of the most high intensity deadly jobs that you could have, you're actually more likely to die from suicide than line of duty death.
This reminded me of something. We used to do these live talks in London, and there was a talk from a guy called Professor Paul Gilbert, and he was talking about veterans in Afghanistan and Iraq. And what would happen is they go out to these war zones and they develop their tribe and they go through like really dangerous situations together, right? And in doing that, they become so tightly bonded to those people. It's something that the concept in psychology is called like your secure base. They become your secure base, your new source of safety in the world, right? Before that, it might have been your wife or your family at home or whatever. But now that they're out there and they're in this tribe, that becomes their secure base. And they feel safe, they feel looked after, they feel like people have got their back. And because the bond's so strong, whenever they then return home and they're back in their community and they're with their family or whatever, their secure base is still in their mind and their body is still their tribe. But now they're separated from it. So even though they're totally safe at home, they don't feel safe at an emotional, biological level because their secure base is elsewhere. And it's totally like, it's not rational, but I don't think we're rational anyway. But I wanted to ask you, because you guys are both veterans, does that resonate at all with either of your experience or any of the people that you've worked with?
Oh, yeah, it's fairly universal from particularly men who have been played team sports at a high level. They're in a jiu-jitsu school. They're a part of a fraternity. They had that secure base, which is formed through trauma bonding and a shared affiliation, which means there's a culture alignment of a shared vision, which is why we're there, and a shared values, which dictates our norms or our behavior. And when we abide by those norms, then it forms the affiliation of kinship. And that's really the biggest driver of overall resiliency, is a sense of belonging with other people that you are embedded in tribe with. And the biggest source of stress, which is, again, chronic and almost universal, is when a man is interacting with another man who is outside of their tribe. And Josh does a lot of great work with the amygdala and the stress response and sympathetic nervous system. when we're around particularly men who are not part of our tribe, it sends off high stress warnings, high cortisol dump, norepinephrine and adrenaline. It's classic stress. And in our culture, we are around strangers constantly. And when you're in the military, particularly deployed, you are never around strangers. And if you are, then they are the other, and they are treated as such. And that's a wartime footing. And it's one of the reasons why we have such a collapse of that secure base that you talk about, or that tribe is, and we're built for it. We are a tribal organism. So this is hardwired into our DNA.
Interesting. And can you guys maybe paint a picture for someone that's curious about what inside K4 actually looks like. What would people expect from joining K4?
Yeah, so
don't tell them our secret handshake. We don't have a secret handshake.
The way men come into K4 is we have what's called a rite of passage experience. And we believe that men need to have the tools and maps in order to engage with the world. And so in that experience, you learn these fundamentals. One, you're put into a group with other men going through the experience. You get tribe immediately. You get other men to build ally, to build as allies. Secondly, you walk through curriculum each week where you're watching curriculum and you're doing investigation, right? You're investigating your own past. You're building awareness on how you show up in the world and kind of taking a look at why you are the way you are. But we use a series of mythopoetic, which in the sample is where you use mythology and story that cannot be as like, this is the way, but it gives a more general perspective through stories, which is how it was brought back. So we're combining cutting edge science compared with ancient wisdom and making it relevant for today. So men can go, oh, how can I take these stories or these maps or these tools? And then how do I apply it to my life today to actually get what I want? So we're helping men build their vision, values. We're helping them learn how to build healthy communities and healthy tribes with men and their family unit. We're helping them learn to regulate their emotions. We're helping them learn to communicate highly effectively with themselves and others and really learn like where they're at in the world. So when they get lost, there's just maps and tools to say, oh, here's where you're at. Here's where you want to go. Here's who you need to be in order to get there. And so when they go through that process together as a unit, they get really close. They start to see that their stories are not their own stories, that it's shared with other men. And then they actually get accountability, which Philip mentioned earlier, like, hey, you said you wanted this. You're getting a little off track, you know, recommit for you. So you get that challenge in a healthy way that feels like accountability versus shame. And then you start to shore up the parts of your life that you've been off track with, and it builds this new vitality. So that's really what men are getting. They're getting tribe, community, culture, and what we call as maps and tools to help them navigate what could seem like we use one metaphor of like a mountain. Imagine you've just been trying to climb this mountain, but you don't have a map and you have no tools, and you're running into points of the mountain where there's a drop off, where you're running into a big jagged bush, right? And so but if somebody just said, here's a map, here's how you get to the top and avoid all the pitfalls, it makes it a lot easier. So we're bringing back that ancient wisdom and making it relevant for men today.
And once men graduate from that 3-month rite of passage program, which is online, then they're part of K4 Nation, which is our ongoing membership. And we meet once a week as a whole community, where either Josh or I or an outside speaker is delivering some of the men's work best practices in a particular field. And then all the men are embedded in what we call a round table, which is an accountability group, which they meet once a week online and are basically held accountable for their goals. And our goal setting process is an acronym, kind of like SMART goals, except we use the term GRAILS, which, you know, each letter of that word stands for, you know, the goals, the reasons, you know, the accountability, and down the line. And that's where the big movement is over time. And so the men that have been with us for, you know, 2 or 3 years, not only are they best friends, that most of the men in K4 share that their K4 brothers are their best friends, but also they're getting big movement in the 4 primary masculine archetypes. That's king, warrior, magician, lover. And K4 stands for that, king of the 4 houses. And each of those 4 archetypes that we all have in us is connected to a big aspect of our life. So our king archetype is really our career, our expression, our creativity. The warrior is our fitness and our healthy boundaries. The magician is our spiritual practice, our mastery, our money, plan, process, procedure. And then our lover archetype is our relationships, which starts with our relationship with ourselves, with our significant others, our families, our coworkers. And so we include those 4 archetypes as a framework for setting holistic goals for our membership.
Very cool. I want to come back to the four archetypes later because I think that's such a powerful, powerful concept. The other thing I wanted to ask you guys about was, what can you make you guys make a distinction between habits and practices? Now, why is this important to do? And the second part of that question is, what practices have had the biggest positive impact on your life that you wish you had have adopted sooner? And we can flip back to Joshua for this one and then go back to Philip.
I would actually, Philip does such a great frame. I'd love him to do the habits and practices. That's his frame. Yeah, that's his frame.
This is something that I actually learned through K4 teaching the hero's journey. And probably most of and you're primarily a men's audience?
No, we're a mix.
Women both. Too?
Yeah.
We have a remarkable amount of women following us too, because the women who love men are deeply involved in men's work. So, I mean, I can't tell you, most of our comments online are, why aren't more men doing this? And how do I get my man in this? And thank you for doing this for men. And so the women who do love men seem to be more engaged in men's work than all of our lone wolves hiding out. So thank you, ladies, for supporting the movement. What were we talking about? Oh, practice. Okay, hero's journey. Okay. the hero's journey is one of the three ancient central maps that men need to navigate the world. And they're universal. So those four archetypes is one of those maps. The hero's journey is another one of those maps. And the hero's journey is a four-phase or four-stage process that all men go through. And it's unavoidable. It seems to be the way that we engage with the world. So call to adventure, road of trials, the garden, and then returning with treasure. Those are the four stages. And when we started talking about, we first have to address our habits. This is the known world. This is our as-is state. That's the first engagement we have with our hero's journey, is looking at our life and realizing our life is a collection of our habits. And some of them are inadequate to having vitality and having money and sex and our bodies and all the things we want. So we have to look at our habits first. And then to address our habits, we have to upgrade them into practices, like you shared. That's hard. That would be the road of trials phase, is trying to get to that stage where we're actually creating long-term practices. And practices are about 90% less efficient than habits. So all of us fail on our practices unless we have accountability, unless we have an engaged, committed group of men who are holding us accountable for maintaining and establishing practices. We will collapse back into habits. We will always choose a familiar hell over an unfamiliar heaven. And that's kind of where my initial, journey on that stopped. But then I realized that third phase of the hero's journey, which is the garden, that's when practices are no longer something that we have to establish. They become non-negotiable, and those become rituals. So our habits become practices, and our practices become rituals, which means they're still hard, but they're non-negotiable. So for those of us who are sober or who meditate every day, or like Josh does breath work, he does cold plunges, those are now rituals for him. And if we can maintain our rituals and then share them, which is really what the hero's journey is sharing what we have discovered in our transformation so that it serves other people. That's the last phase of the hero's journey. And it's when our rituals become traditions. So habit, practice, ritual, tradition. And then, of course, our traditions at some point have to be questioned because they've become habits, and the journey begins again. So the hero's journey is not a one-way trip. It's an endless spiral going upwards to wherever we end up.
And yeah, the What I'll add to that is, I think Philip, as Philip alluded to, we've been learning as we've been doing this. I mean, we stepped into, we've both been in men's work a long time, but when you're teaching it and then also coming together with different sides of the journey, it allows us to build much faster, right? And so we have different archetypes as our primary nature. So we're able to, we're the actually ideal, let's call it archetypes to help each other as allies. And so we've been able to help each other spring forward and shore up the parts of each of our houses, those masculine houses, which were a little bit weaker because of that accountability. So for me, some of the big shifts is putting healthy boundaries. I have a lot of magician lever. So I'm really good at rigidity. I'm really good at structure. I'm really good at the lever house. It's a lot of the work that I do. Where I struggled, even though I have a lot of warrior king, is I struggled in those areas to put some healthy boundaries in place. So for me, establishing some healthy practices and boundaries to shore up some of the addictive behavior that I had in place has been really the most transformational. And then also, I was teaching emotional regulation, but the difference of doing it daily, I realized what I call looping. You stop looping unhealthy behaviors. You stop having emotional blowouts. And I wasn't doing it daily at first. So actually raising the bar and actually helping, because I saw other people looping and I realized I wasn't being in integrity there. So raising the bar with that and actually repping it one to multiple times a day, I'd say is probably the greatest shift that I've had. And not only that, but I mean, I transformed my health. I did a bodybuilding show. Like, I mean, it's like Philip and I have been like really holding the line to really challenge each other to not let each other go. It's like, hey, this is your calling. This is what you got to do. Like, fucking own it. I hope it's okay to cuss on here, but and so it's been transforming every area of my life, from relationship to how I do relationship, to how I show up in my health, to how I show up at the gym, to my purpose and getting projects done. It works, right? I'd say the hardest part is just like the consistency and recommitment day in and day out. It's like, it's not these big jumps. Like everybody thinks like, oh, I'm going to have this massive transformation. So I'd say my biggest shift has been like, that was me. I was swinging for the fence. I'd go all in and really a lot of rigidity, and I'd blow a fuse and I'd burn out. And that was the unhealthy pattern that I kept repeating, versus now I'm like, oh, this is my 20-year timeline. And here's the practices that I need to do daily, day in and day out, to have not only purpose in the world and meaning in the world, but also vitality in the world, so that I'm a vital human, so that I can actually run the marathon and it's not these short sprints anymore. So the practices that are non-negotiables are put in place so that I can live that marathon and actually enjoy a very long life. And it normalizes things here. Like, so for me, it's like, I can actually live a life now. I don't have to wait until I get there to start living, which was the previous version of myself. I'm like, I get to live now. I'm doing dance class and I'm doing all these other things that are vitality based, that bring me a lot of joy, that are regulating my nervous system. So that's probably been the biggest shift for me. What about you, Philip?
Well, one of the things about the archetypes that Josh alluded to, and this comes from kind of not only mythology, but also psychology, and it's a fairly well-researched, accepted field that we have four big buckets of behavior. These are done with psychometrics like Myers-Briggs and DISC and other things. It's straight mythology and it's straight anthropology. So these four roles exist in tribal cultures. They exist in all of our great stories. Heroes always find allies, and the allies they find are the complement to them, which means they're very different. So we're a species that is designed to be specialized, and a team of aligned specialists will always be a team of generalists. You don't have to be everything and do everything as a man to be successful. You do need to be in an alliance with those men that complete you. So we're all specialists. We're all the funny outgoing guy, or you're the really disciplined competitive guy, or you're the really smart analytical guy, dude, or you're the heart-based guy, right? You know, who everybody likes, and you know, they want to call you with their problems and, you know, resiliency and all that. So we're designed to be in teams of very different complementary people. And that's another huge loss to that lone wolf dynamic we talked about, is when you isolate and you lone wolf, you have to do everything yourself. And it's simply not tenable because you have to downgrade and compromise all the other houses for that generality. So when Josh said he's a strong lover, magician combination archetype, I happen to be strong king warrior. And it's what I was built to do in the same way Josh is built to do, you know, resiliencies, relationship, conflict resolution, which he, you know, he's one of the best in the world at. And so when we get together and we deeply connect with our complement, other men, our allies on our hero's journey, then we all win. We benefit from them. There's a collective journey that we need to be on, and it does need to be reciprocal, but it drives collaboration, celebration. All the things that are great come from that dynamic.
Makes a lot of sense. With the four archetypes, what if someone's listening to this and they're like really excited by the concept, how can they identify which of the archetypes they might be weak in? Like, how can they know if they might be stronger as a warrior than a lover, for example? How do you guys help your cohort do that?
Well, we do an assessment. So I think it's week three in their rite of passage is the men do an online assessment, which gives them their primary archetype that they're existing in currently. And it also gives you the one that you're the weakest in. And that is the one where you need partnership and you also need to explore. And it's that diagonal archetype is usually the one where the men, we all have the most resistance to moving into. I'm very resistant to the magician archetype because I'm primarily the king archetype. And so for me to move into my magician house and get detailed and granular and schedule and time block, it feels like death to me. Like it literally feels like my freedom is being bled out. And so I have a tremendous resistance to it. And it's the reason why I'm not as successful as I could have been, is that I haven't gone into the cave I fear to enter that contains the treasure I seek. So that diagonal or that Achilles heel that we all have is the biggest source of transformation. And it really is the hero's journey, is getting into that identity that is uncomfortable for us.
Sure. Joshua, can you tell me about the perfect day and why this is such a powerful tool for people?
Yeah, the perfect day is like, I think so often we're in the future about where we want to be, and we're not actually looking at how we want to feel and what our day wants to be like. And so oftentimes, I mean, I've done goal setting for years, even back when I was with Tony Robbins and ripped through so many goal setting programs. And what I find is when you're actually able to just look at like, what's my ideal day look like? And what am I doing with my time? Because time is the most precious resource. It starts to normalize what that starts to look like for you. And I remember when I first did it, instead of this big goal that I was like way in the future for, that's like, oh, I'm going to be, you know, this is 20 years down the road. I started writing out the perfect day. I'm like, I'm actually not that far off. You know, I'm actually almost living my perfect day now. So it starts to kind of ground, like, what are you doing with your time? Are you spending time with family, with friends? Are you, because I was a workaholic, you know, for me, I was a workaholic. I'm at the opposite quadrant than Philip. So for me, I didn't have a hard time working. I had a hard time playing. I had a hard time having fun. I had a hard time like being more in my expression in the world. I would hide in a cave and work around the clock. So for me, getting out into the world was that shift. And so when I looked at it, if I'm reading, writing, speaking, studying content, and then spending time with those I love, in addition to like the training and having fun, that's what my day looks like. And it just kind of normalizes, like, I'm not that far off. And I find that's the case often. It's like, we just may not be seeing the results that we want yet and think we have to do all this stuff, but it's the little shifts. It's not the big shifts that actually create the most results. So it's the little tiny shifts day in and day out that are just as easy to do and then just as easy not to do, right? So if you're doing them, you go in this trajectory. If you're not doing them, you go in this trajectory, but there are these little shifts daily. So it's like, oh, I just need to shift a little bit each day to back to what we said earlier, to do these practices that are going to move me towards what I actually want in life, versus it's just as easy to go, I'm feeling inadequate, so I'm going to eat the shitty food, or I'm feeling inadequate, so I'm going to watch the movie, or I'm feeling inadequate, so I'm going to stay in this unhealthy relationship, even though it's not giving me anything I want, versus lean into those practices to take a step forward. Those things actually move us to a trajectory of where we want to be in life. So I think that's the biggest shift that I've gotten from that practice.
And I'll add a couple pieces to that too. Life can be taken, and we want to take it as simplistically as we can. And that's why maps are valuable. Maps are very simple symbols that represent incredibly complex things. And so if you have a map, you're able to actually look at this graphic or a symbol and go, okay, this makes sense. I can navigate my life off of that. And so when we're looking at our life, the most simplistic way is to say, I want to get more of what I want and less of what I don't. I mean, that's life, if you want to just get it down to that. So our perfect day is all the things we should be doing that get us what we want. And your perfect day also includes all the things you should not be doing, right? And that's the list. And that's my list. That's my perfect day. And I make sure that I can see it all the time. And I don't ever, I rarely, and maybe I'm a little behind you on Josh on this one, but I rarely hit my perfect day. Like I have to build up my protocol, my practices, my rituals. And, you know, maybe once a month, I'll get one of those perfect days where it's like, hey man, I ate clean. I limited my screen time. I, you know, meditated, stretched, worked out, was a great dad, great husband. Like I might hit all my marks, but we're human. And we do fail. So that perfect day is basically the set of commandments that allows us to navigate through this trackless desert of a modern life. And so nobody's giving you these commandments, and nobody should. You know, at this point in our human evolution, we have to provide our own commandments. We are fathering ourselves, like Josh said. So that perfect day is really the commandments that allow you to create a life in the pursuit of something that is significant.
And just to add on to it, because I think it's a really important point. What we find is most men, when they initially come through, at least the rite of passage, they realize they haven't been hunting big game. So when Philip says something significant, they haven't actually been going after their dreams. They haven't been actually going after a relationship, which is the most relationship and intimate and connected and alive they've ever experienced. They're not going after taking care of their bodies and actually becoming what feels really good in their body and a lot of self-love. Like they've kind of settled to their current normal lifestyle. And oftentimes they're spending their time in distraction or numbing or avoidance with their time. So re-engaging with this perfect day of like, who do I want to be and what do I need to do to get there? Actually gives them an action plan to start to step into that. And then again, you combine that with accountability, right, to those practices. That's kind of the sweet spot of like, here's my vision for my life. Here's who I want to be. I'm going to set quarterly goals on a group setting to give me some accountability to do it. Now the accountability is like, here's the little micro movements of actions I'm going to take to move me towards that goal. And then we're all prone to fall off. I fall off too, but I got accountability to challenge me when I get fall back to recommit, to go towards that, right? And that's really the trajectory. It's actually pretty simple when you look at it. That's the hardest part, is just following that day in and day out over long periods of time to become the men that we want to be. Just like you create the relationship that you want, you create the body you want, you create the bank account that you want from the same fundamental practices.
The tool, you know, I was listening to you guys talk about it. I actually tried it myself. It's so simple, but like just to make a list of the things that you should do and the things that you shouldn't do for your perfect day. And you see that in front of you, and it's very clear, you know, it's simple, but it's not easy to do. And the thing that it strikes me is that that is one of the most effective tools I've ever come across for having integrity. Because if you do those things, you have integrity, and if you avoid doing the things that you know break integrity, then you've got it, you know. And I don't think there's anything more valuable you can have as a human being than that thing, that than integrity, you know. So another thing that, you know, seems to be a common theme in your work is shadow work. What are your thoughts about this? And we can go back to a bit of mythology here, but what's the difference between killing the dragon and taming the dragon? And whoever wants to answer this one can tackle. Anyone who want to jump in here?
You do shadow work, I'll do dragon.
Yeah, so big picture, I think to answer this question, I want to go a little bit broader, just because I do so much coaching, I'm in it day in and day out, and I think this may like put some context to it, because shadow work sounds like an elusive thing, and there's actually very different kinds of shadow work out there, right? So there's such a broad spectrum of what that means to people. But the frame I'll use is, here's how I see the world. Oftentimes, most people are walking around with a bunch of trauma. There's big T trauma and little T trauma. Big T is the things that we think about, like, oh, somebody was abandoned or raped or abused or something that they think is trauma. And then every single human on the planet has little T trauma. Little T trauma is when we're little kids. Philip says this a lot, you know, give me the boy, the Jesuits say, give me the boy till nine, I'll show you the man. Is oftentimes as little kids, we go through life and we didn't get our needs met, right? There's a shift that happens when we're getting the love we need to them when we become an adolescent, where we experience, I found typically abandonment or inadequacy are the two ways we didn't get our needs met. And when that happens, we step into a survival identity to survive that. So if you look at most humans through at least the lens I'm looking through, majority of the planet is walking around with a ton of past pain and trauma that they've never processed, that's beneath the surface. And it's like a pressure cooker that keeps building. They're walking around without any awareness of their nervous system and how they're dysregulated through most of the day. So they're in the back of their brain in reactive states, in survival states. And so they're kind of walking through the world in survival majority of the time and codependency patterns. And so what I'll get back to shadow in a second. So first, if we can actually get regulated, we move to the front of the brain where we're like, oh, I'm compassionate, empathetic, and I can think rationally. I can actually be aware of what's happening with my body and what's happening in the present moment. That's why you got to do it daily. It's not optional. And then when I'm in a pattern, I can see it and I can start to go in to go, let me get really curious. What's happening inside of me? What's this triggering inside of me from my past, right? So there's a lot of ways to explore that where you're giving embodiment to what's called, like, let's call it the shadow side of us. The shadow side is shadow work. And that shadow work can look anything like offloading grief and trauma from the past to creative ways to explore the uncomfortable parts of who we are, to looking at why am I judging this or why am I triggering by that? And where do I either have that in the gutter or have an affiliation for that, right? So there's a lot of practices we're doing, but on a high level, I look at it like we're removing that pressure and we're starting to become more present and move from the head through the throat, down to the heart, down to the gut. So for me, that's where you feel integration with other men. Like I can feel it pretty quickly in a couple of seconds, how integrated, and I'm feeling, are they here? Are they here? Are they here? Or are they here? If they were able to do some shadow work and get into the messy parts of life, you feel them gutturally. It feels integrated because they're actually able to look at the most uncomfortable parts of themselves and face those. And that's what I'm kind of teeing up Philip for his next part of the dragon scenario. But initially, we've all had some sort of victimization. And when that happens, we're in the road of trials part. Again, all of our maps tie in together. We're road of trials because we feel victimized. And that's what, let me put in context. I'm a child. Father was an asshole. So now I'm on a quest to prove dad wrong. And I have this anger out into the world. And then at some point, that anger out in the world, and when I do the shadow work and start to face myself and face these confronting past, I realize I've been fighting myself. And that's the most confronting piece. And so when I'm able to learn to love myself, that's when this really dragon metaphor changes from fighting the dragon to, you know, riding or becoming the dragon. I'll let Philip go deeper into this next piece.
And Josh used the term clearing the tanks. We take on, you know, emotional debris from engaging with the adversity and the unavoidable suffering of life. And we carry that. I mean, right, Josh, the issues in the tissues, right? So we carry a lot of that that can't be released without some sort of somatic work. So I think the classic shadow work that maybe you're alluding to is that big emotional discharge. And again, this is not a new, like, pop culture, new age thing of shadow work. Men have been doing shadow work forever. And it's the way we come back and do a sweat lodge, the way we purify. It's the way that we go on a vision quest. It's the way that we're embraced after a hard event. So there's a lot of different ways that humans discharge, but it's messy and it's dark. And there, you know, it's a very vulnerable experience that cannot be conducted without tribe. We will carry the burden of trauma and shame and everything else our entire lives unless we have a safe enough place where we are capable of discharging it. All right, so I'll take the baton into the dragon. And when Josh said, when we're young, we take on some core wounds, core trauma. And like he said, it's either we were abandoned or we were found inadequate. Those are the source of our big operating system worldview that we carry throughout our life, is that we're desperately trying to control relationships so we don't get abandoned. Or we're desperately trying to achieve enough power and significance that we're not inadequate. And that that villain in the story of abandonment or inadequacy is our dragon. It is the beast that has been chasing us around since we were children. And we're running it, we're fighting it, we're engaging with it. And at some point in the hero's journey, we discover that we have found our allies that will hold us accountable, keep us safe, that we can trust. We have been provided the elder wisdom of the frame or the map or the plan to address that issue. And we have achieved enough supernatural aid, which is faith, and we have a purpose and we're supported. Those are the three big things that allow us to confront our dragon, our old story, our inner critic. And when we do have those stars align, and they're destined for all of us, allies, elder wisdom, supernatural aid, it's promised to all travelers of the hero's journey, we're able to now stop running and fighting the dragon to actually going in and taking a look at it. And that's when Josh says, at some point you have to look inwards. And that monster that has been dictating your life has your face on it. It has always been you. Since you were an adult, it has been you. You can no longer blame your dad. You can't blame the government. You can't blame society, other men, a bad boss. It's you. And that's the, in the hero's journey, is called the abyss or the ordeal. And for some men, it's rock bottom. We have to hit rock bottom to go, all right, I have to now look inward because there's no one else I can blame. And usually that's the transformational moment. And in all of the great stories, that's the point when the hero is defeated and then has to rebuild him or herself into a different version, a more mature version, a more idealistic or high integrity version, one who is serving others instead of themselves. And that means we now have a relationship with the dragon because it's us. It's no longer an external thing. Like Josh mentioned, if I'm a victim, externally, there's a villain who is persecuting me. And there's going to be a savior who will come save me. As soon as you've met the dragon and realized it's you, you realize that you're not a victim. There is no villains in the world and no one is coming to save you. And that is the moment of transformation. That's the rebirth of the phoenix. And at that point, the dragon is a very different character in the story. It's no longer driving the story. And at some point, we also realize that that dragon was probably the greatest gift in our life because it made us great. It made us It forced us to engage with relationships. It forced us to engage with discipline and success. So that dragon is actually the thing that we need to stop running from and fighting and learning how to ride, because that dragon is the big engine that powers on our entire hero's journey and ultimately allows us to return with that treasure, which only was created from the dragon itself. So it's a very, very multifaceted, fluid relationship that we have with our old trauma, how it has rewired our worldview, and how it has inspired and driven us to a different version of ourselves. And that's our gift. That story that we are all undertaking is really our biggest gift to the world. And we are evidence of our efficacy. Whether you're a coach or you're a boss or you're a seeker, the greatest thing that we're offering the world is the evidence of our lives. And that ultimately is the end of the hero's journey cycle.
That's beautifully said. And just to clarify, so are we saying here that our deepest wound is the source of our greatest power in some sense? Like Okay. A couple of questions now just to wrap up, guys. Big picture, broadly speaking, if you could get a letter to every man in the world that wanted to become the best version of himself, what would be some of the key points that you would make sure that you would include in that letter? So we can start with Joshua here, and then we can round out with Philip.
Yeah, great question. I love the question. I'd say one of the big fundamentals is tribe, right? Like he needs to be around tribe. Yeah, I just think what are the things he needs to learn, or like maybe just give a little bit more context. I was thinking a letter, but like what would he need to hear in the letter, or what would he need to do in the letter? Like what would be the ideal context there?
You're essentially just getting a letter to someone that has the intention to become the best version of themselves, and you're giving them like big picture. These are the most important things you need to get right. You need to get your tribe right. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So for me, it would be tribe, mentorship, good men, like elders. Like the faster you can get a good group of elder men to help guide you, super important. Integrated elder men, right? Which can take a little while to figure out and find. Also just the deep desire to go after his dreams, because it's not in failing that he's going to be having regrets. It's going to be the areas he didn't go after his dreams that he has regrets. So to really get clear on what is his greatest dreams, what are his greatest visions, and to have the courage to go after those dreams and visions, and to trust that he'll find allies along the way or people along the way to keep guiding him. So for me, it'd be more inspirational support of elder wisdom, tribe, community, going after his dreams, having the courage to go after it sooner than later, and allowing himself to have fun with the process, like to really not be so rigid in that approach, but actually to enjoy every step of the process.
And you'll notice that a lot of what Josh said as his priorities are about relationship, tribe, mentorship, integration. That's warrior magician. I'm sorry, lover magician. And so my frame on that would be the same exact thing, except seen through the lens of more king warrior. And so I would lead with, if there's something in your life that is not as good as it could be, it is because you are not as good as you could be yet. And that's a warrior frame on it. And I would also share that it's really not the fear of failure that is stopping you from starting your journey. It's the fear of what success will require from you. And again, this is the difference of our archetypes, is that compassion, love, tribe, maps, and then discipline, engagement, aspiration, and that's really what rounds out masculinity. And it really is the balance between being a powerful man and being a good man.
That's such an interesting thought, that it's not a fear of failure that's stopping us. It's a fear of what success might require us to be. You know, that's a big thing. Funnily enough, I used to play a sport in Ireland called Gaelic football. And anytime I would do something really good in the game, like score like a really good point or whatever, there would be part of me that would sort of just be saying, you know, like, right, calm down now, like, don't get carried away, like, really sort of hold back, you know. And I think it's the same tendency expressing itself in that context. So just to round out here, guys, Josh, you've got an amazing film coming up soon. Can you maybe tell us a bit about this? It's about grief, am I right in saying? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, it's called The Gift of Grief. I actually documented my journey over 10 years after the death of my brother and all the things I did to actually put myself back together again. And it has clips of doing men's work. It has clips of us training first responders. So it's really, it takes the viewer on a journey. And what I've heard from just a couple of screenings I've done is that it's like medicinal. It's going to walk you through an experience to make you recognize where you may still have grief trapped in the body and give you some resources and suggestions on where to go and what to do about it. So I'm going to be putting together a strategy of where that'll be coming out. It'll be more of an online launch, but that's coming out sometime this year.
Fantastic. And people can find that where would they find that when it comes out?
Just on my site. If they go to joshuawenner.com, one of the places it says The Gift of Grief. And on that page, they can sign up to be first to know when it's released.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And Philip, you've just published a book on Tribe, the Triangle Tribe. I'm getting the title wrong. Team the Tribe. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. This is my 52-step roadmap to building an honor-based culture, which is kinship, and it is tribe. And the reclamation of kinship is really the primary theme of our whole talk today. We need tribe. It's how we go from shame to accountability. It's how we go from practice to ritual. Tribe sits at the very core of it. And the reclamation of kinship and tribe solves our resiliency issues, and we talked about that with veterans, and it solves all of our success issues, and we talked about this for the last hour. So it all comes down to, you know, one primary source is, have you built an aligned kinship or tribe team with your family and your organization? And so that book is the 52-step journey on how to do that. Available on Amazon.
Okay. So guys, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you both today. I want to thank you both for the work that you're doing. I think it's so important in the culture we live in. I think both of you are serving as excellent role models for what men can aspire to be. And obviously your work's in progress, but it's really great to have to be able to speak with men like yourselves. So I really appreciate it. And I want to wish you all the best with your work going forward.
Thanks so much. Such a fun call. Appreciate being on.
Yeah, man. Thank you, brother.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you'd like to hear the full version, you can do so with the Weekend University Premium Membership. This gets you access to our master library of over 5 years of psychology conferences, including over 230 talks and interviews with the world's leading psychologists, professors, and authors, unlimited CPD certification, transcripts, quizzes, premium passes for our annual conference, online courses with Richard Schwartz and Deb Dana, and more. The cost is £97 for 1 year, which breaks down at around 27p per day. The best bit is you can try it out for 30 days completely risk-free, as all orders come with a 100% money-back guarantee. If you're interested, please go to twumembers.com for more information.